So we were talking about a brand new constitution for the United States that has been prepared.
One president for 9 years. The Senate's appointed. Two vice presidents. You forgot to mention that. There's going to be
two vice presidents
that would supervise affairs. Now, I think that Conley and Agnew, if this new constitution would go in, if Nixon is in and isn't killed, then Conley and Agnew could be the two vice presidents. If he's killed, you could make Conley the president, Rockefeller and Agnew. They're grooming for this position. You've got some top men there, see?
I think Martin and Lewis might.
Martin and Lewis. But you had two vice presidents, a Senate that's appointed, and the end of the Bill of Rights.
This is not just something that's drawn up overnight by some 12th grade government class.
No. And I want to emphasize this point, that a Mr. Tugwell, who worked with Roosevelt, under Roosevelt's administration, worked with him, who taught economics at the university, Columbia University in New York, helped, his name is in front of this, although the whole group of commission worked on this, his name goes to this new study on the Constitution. And Rex Tugwell said that institutions no longer serve the needs of modern society any more like than totem poles, that our traditional Constitution doesn't serve the needs of a modern society. Translated, it means if you're going to stop us from getting the oil and the gold and all the things we need and get yourselves an education and question who runs this system, then we've got to change the rules of the game. We've got to change our rules because a modern society needs oil, it needs imperialism, it needs slave labor. And if you're going to change the rules, if all those blacks are going to come up from the South and begin the civil rights thing and want fair housing and all the advantages that America could offer them, we're going to change the rules of the game. So he says there was a new charter made for modern America. The basis of Mr. Tugwell's political theorem is his conviction, I mean this from the New York Times, is his conviction that representative democracy is not only compatible with government planning, but it may not survive without it. That in order to have, he says, in order to have a representative democracy, that you have to come in now and bring a new type of constitution, meaning that a representative government will be one who looks over the interests of the country, and the interest of the country is to maintain the economy. That's the way he figures it out, see? So then he says that if he's successful in getting this constitution through, his firm belief that the existing charter that we have of the constitution in America is outgrown, that if he's successful, it would be through his work and the other people who helped him write it, and that he had help in writing this, that most of the colleagues agreed that this was a good constitution. And I repeat that Warren Burger, who was not yet, this was before his appointment as Chief Justice, argued to do away with the trial by jury. And that's where Mr. Burger's head is at. Along with the new constitution, I brought in the plan to revise the cabinet. Now, it's very important to see who's doing all this. If these were just people off in some strange land, it would be different. Roy Ash, I've mentioned his name several times on the shows, is the head of Lytton Industries, and that was the organization, the conduit of funds that overthrew Greece and helped it become a fascist dictatorship. And Roy Ash is designing the cabinet, which is identical to Greece, just like this constitution is like Greece. They can't bear arms and there's no trial by jury, and the head of the government can run 9 years, and there's no court, you see. So we're making provisions to legalize what they did. You see, I know the government here was overthrown in 1963 in Dallas. Now they're pulling in all their laws to have the same effect they had in Greece, and the same men that overthrew Greece are designing our cabinets. Now, in 1971, there was an article, it was in February 71, that Roy Ash was planning a whole revision, a government reorganization for President Nixon, but he wouldn't bring it out in an election year because people might not like it. So, when I talk about leaving the United States, I don't want to be around after the next election because I have hundreds of articles like this. I'm just bringing in the Constitution, the cabinet. This Ash-type commission is working under presidential guidelines. That means that Mr. Nixon is helping him do that, and he said this prestigious commission might enhance Nixon's chance of making reform an issue for re-election, but they're not going to announce it until after the election. See, they're going to say, we have major reforms planned, but we're not going to announce them. Now, the plan that I talked about once before, twice on the show, was that the only branches of the government, the only cabinets, would be the Department of State. Then I put that under, you know, Kissinger or Rockefeller, Department of the Treasury, Department of Defense, and the Department of Justice. Now, you have, those are the four most important things, your law courts and your surveillance, your police system, your data banks, all goes under justice, surveillance, and so forth, because anybody who questions the legality of the existing state is an enemy against the state, too. The Department of Justice, the Department of Defense, you know, this is defense to be in Vietnam. You know, there was an article last week about doublethink language, and there's an institute of teachers that are coming out with a study where they're asking people to analyze the words that we're reading and turn in words where we have what they call doublethink, like 1984. And one example was we had the War Department until, you know, 1945 or 47. It was called the War Department. And then we turned to the Department of Defense and started making these gigantic weapons that we're using now, like the napalm that burned all those kids.
We should have a Department of Offense.
Yeah, Max. Then there's the Treasury that controls all the money and the taxes and the means of making war, and the Department of State that decides which countries you recognize, whose oil you take, and these two. Now, what they're going to do away with entirely are the other departments of the cabinet that we've had all these years. This proposal, I'm reading from, this is the Washington Post, 1971. This proposal of President Nixon, it was designed by Roy Ash, and Secretary of the Treasury John Conley said the chances of passing this are very good. Here's your John Conley, the oil Conley again. Conley said that Roy Ash, president of Lytton Industries and chairman of the commission that recommended these changes, would save us $5 billion a year. You know, we've spent that in the last couple of weeks in Vietnam. Now here, the proposal would do away with Department of the Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Health, Education, Welfare, Housing, Urban Development, and Transportation. That's the United States of America you're going to have. And in their places, they would condense four departments under the State, Treasury, Defense, and Justice. And the excuse would be to save money. If you read what the space shuttle is costing, just that trip, they can make 100 trips for a handful of men to get to the moon, which is going to cost $52 billion. This is what he said. By eliminating these departments, we can have a space shuttle for 30 men to take maybe at the most 100 trips to space. By eliminating every one of these, so that you're taking away all protections for land and recreation, water resources, energy and mineral resources, marine, atmospheric, terrestrial resources, technology, Indians and territory. I'm listing these, every one of them, because these are things you have in America, and if you don't know what you're going to lose, you don't know what the assassination of John Kennedy was about. This is what it's all about. We're going to do away with the health services. When I say do away, they're going to be under the control of the president and nobody else, and he's elected 9 years. And the appointed past presidents and military decide who is nominated for president. They decide the electoral system and what money. They'll decide the candidate and the president. All of these account to nobody but that man, not to any other department. Health service, income maintenance, your security, education, manpower, that gets into your slave, social and rehabilitation services, food and commodity, domestic and international commerce, science and technology. Here you can read some of these, Phil. Here's some more departments with the labor. These are to be eliminated. They only account to the president.
Let's see.
I left off with labor relations
standards.
Labor.
Aren't these under four other departments that they're going to create that would be directly under the president? Department of Economic Affairs is something we don't have now, and Department of Community Development we don't have
we
now.
We have those things down there, like health, education.
Different name,
health.
Yeah.
The reason I'm reading the list is that all of the things that we have are broken down into separate cabinets. If there's a health, education, and welfare, and a man like, say, Mr. Panetta, who lives on the Monterey Peninsula, worked for Nixon, and he left that administration and says the minorities aren't getting a fair shake, and he comes home and speaks about, there won't be such groups. The president will decide what is for you to do, and he decides it now. A man that works for him comes home and says, no, this system isn't working. The point I'm trying to make is that all these different branches are under the jurisdiction of only the president, and you can't complain. If the president is selected by the Senate and the Senate is appointed by former people who've proved where their head is at, then none of these things like housing, highway, mass transit, you know, there's no one that's going to represent you if a freeway goes right through the middle of your town, like the process that we have now. We speak up, raise a lot of noise, and sometimes we divert the freeway, you know, and sometimes we don't. But we have a 50-50 chance or even 5 chances out of 100, you know. But all of this, insurance programs and everything, will be under the supervision of the president.
I wonder if people would be interested in having copies of this, these articles.
Well, if they want them, Phil, all they have to do is go to the library. They have microfilm of the New York Times.
This is
September
7th.
September the 8th, 1970.
Okay.
If anyone has an interest in this, the libraries have microfilm of the New York Times, or you can write to the New York Times and get a copy.
Or the Los Angeles Times had an article on this, too, September 13th, 1970.
A lot of newspapers had an article about the Constitution, a few of them, when it came out. But this is an interesting thing. You read an article, and it doesn't stay in your head. But the way I do my research, and I've mentioned this before, I put in columns. And by putting it in columns, you get a clearer picture. So the article in the New York Times has a list what our present Constitution is. And then on the other side, they have what they would do away with. And that's why it's easier to take notice of the intent and of Warren Berger's position about no trial by jury. I was doing some work this week writing about President Nixon and his political career on the past political assassinations and why every single one of them, 3 murders and 2 accidents, served only one purpose, and that was Richard Nixon. And I was writing that Patrick Gray III went to Annapolis, and he had a Navy career, 20 years, and he left that career in the Navy to help work on Nixon's campaign in 1960. So he knew Nixon was going to go somewhere, and Mr. Patrick Gray is acting head of the FBI now, and he says, to be head of the FBI isn't a political position. I'm not political. And yet he left a full-time Navy career to work in Nixon's campaign, to give up an Annapolis training to run a presidential campaign. Now, getting back to that world... did you have some question, Phil?
Well, I was going to bring up somebody else who left a campaign, left a job to work on a campaign,
Mitchell.
John Mitchell, and what happened Thursday with Richard Kleindienst.
Yeah. You see, John Mitchell, if he's going to give up one of the most important jobs in the United States as head of the Justice Department and run... Richard Nixon's campaign, how can he be objective about a Justice Department, you know, and what's going on in the Justice Department? One of the things that is important to remember is that the White House was totally controlled by the oil people and the mineral people. John Foster Dulles called himself the man who could control Eisenhower. Alan Dulles was described in a recent book by Cookridge, the book on Reinhard Galen, as he described Alan Dulles as being the third most important man in the world. He was on the Warren Commission. He combined agencies of our Central Intelligence Agency with all German intelligence, and they controlled the White House. They had Eisenhower out playing golf, and Richard Nixon was their selected agent for 8 years, sitting in a seat where they made every decision of foreign aid or what country was an enemy, who was our friends, what to do with our economy. Well, in 1960, when Nixon ran against Kennedy, and lost, the provision was made to get rid of Kennedy right then. And my research is different than the other people who do their work. They think that one of the reasons for killing Kennedy was an anger by the people at the Bay of Pigs because he pulled back. And my research indicates that the decision to kill Kennedy was made in 1961. It was probably made when Johnson accepted the vice presidency because John Connally was his campaign manager. And again, all that oil of Texas was not going to go to the Kennedy family, for sure. And not the family, but the man who was going to change country and give it to the youth the opportunity to make their own decisions. So John Kennedy was killed. And on the Warren Commission was John James McCloy and Alan Dulles and a lot of people. One of the men on the Warren Commission was Gerald Ford, who was very angry that the new bill that went through this week of education didn't get all of the anti-busing he wanted on it. He didn't want the busing thing, and he's been wanting to make Vietnam a parking lot for the vast 10 years with atomic bombs, and Dick Russell of Georgia, everyone on that Warren Commission was pro-Vietnam, pro-military, anti-civil rights, every single member of the Warren Commission. So they controlled the White House under with Nixon sitting there, and with Johnson coming into office was not a change of administrations, because Johnson and Nixon and Connally, Rockefeller were all part of a team. And so in 1968, when Bobby came along, you didn't have to wait for an inauguration. They just weren't going to have him around. And as soon as he won the primary, the provisions were made, you know, take him away, which they did. And in 1969, it seemed that the only man who could defeat Richard Nixon in 72, according to articles I was saving in, even then, was going to be Ted Kennedy. And that wasn't based on any of Ted's political astuteness. It was sort of an emotional guilt that the nation was feeling, I think, a national guilt that they knew something was wrong and felt pretty bad about it, and they'd give him a chance. So they didn't wait until a primary or an inauguration. They gave him a dunking arranged by the CIA up at Chappaquiddick. You know, there's books coming out on Chappaquiddick, a lot of research. The truth isn't told about that at all. And in case, you know, the American people didn't buy that story about the dead girl, the chick, and the frame-up. And nobody really knows the details, but nobody cared. It didn't have the effect it was going to have. So Time magazine this last week said, look what happened to Wallace, that if Kennedy wants to run, that's suicide. They've told him, you know, look what happened to Wallace. So then along comes Nixon, and he's removed his competition for 1972, but he didn't anticipate the popular appeal of George Wallace. There was no way 3 years ago to predict that a populist person would make a dent in that Southern strategy that Mitchell had designed. You know, they knew they'd lose the youth votes because they don't intend to end Vietnam. We escalated with troops going into North Vietnam. We bombed harder and farther north. We're blowing up the dikes. We're dropping napalm. That war, no matter how much you people protest or listen or sign your little petitions, everyone comes around, have you signed the air war petition? That's not where it's at. You know, I meet more people, they say, did you sign the marijuana thing? Did you sign the air war? You are losing your time. You're wasting your lives. I cut out an article last Sunday's paper. It says the bombing, the increased bombing in Vietnam, cost this government $15 to $20 million every single day. This was the accounts last week. And Laird said, we have to have a new increase of $42 billion because of the expense of bombing Vietnam. I want to say that the killing of all these different people was systematically planned to keep the power in the same hands, the same Nazi American hands, the same people that financed Hitler, brought hundreds and hundreds of his agents over to this country. There's people over at the Presidio School teaching German, paid by you taxpayers, who have an airplane hanging there with Nazi swastikas on their desk, who were members of the SS troop of Hitler, and they're teaching over at the Presidio.
No, I mean, really?
Yes, I could read the list. I'll give you a name. I have a list at home of the names of the teachers, and when the students say to them over at the Presidio, what about Hitler, you know, and the war, and they say Hitler was right, and they have German swastikas on their desk, and members of the SS troop of Hitler teaching German on the Monterey Peninsula. Imports. That's, you know, you sign an air war petition to people in the area where I speak, like Santa Cruz, Salinas, and Carmel. Why don't you sign a petition to get those Nazis out of this country and really sit down with a book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and realize that the incorporation of those Germans into this country is not going to end this war. Reinhard Gehlen, who wanted to make 40 million slaves and 40 million dead, he's doing that in Asia. He's alive. He worked with Alan Dulles. He formed our whole CIA with Richard Helms. That's what's happening. Getting back to the chronology of Nixon, Mitchell he designed the Southern Strategy. I have a whole book on it. They didn't anticipate Wallace. And Wallace all of a sudden surfaced. So on the eve of his primary, he caught them by surprise. Wallace was shot. I brought in a newsletter. I bring up this subject many times. Joe Justine in Germany is a writer who wrote many books on government and history in Germany before Hitler took over. He's a man about 75 years old. And after the war, he came back to writing books in Germany. And the minute John Kennedy was killed, he understood history. He's much older than me, and he could look back and see what happened then and could see who was moving the decisions about the commission and so forth. But before the commission even was appointed, it was appointed in December, I guess about that date, he came right out to Dallas from Germany, went back to Germany and wrote a book called Oswald Assassin or Fall Guy. And it's a very good book. Then he wrote another book on Lyndon Johnson, and he wrote one on, he wrote about the oil people. And he's written 7 books on the political assassinations. And he has a newsletter. If you want to subscribe to it, it's kind of expensive, but it's a beautiful newsletter, and it comes out every 2 weeks. And he has 4 pages that are continuous subjects, and you take them apart, and they're books at the end of the year. He sells them as books, and you can save them. And the last one just came this week. It's dated June the 1st, and it came from Germany. His address is 7890 Gutenberg, Germany. J-O-E-S-T-E-N is his name. He has a longer name, Joachim. I don't know the German pronunciation. But this is what he wrote in his newsletter that came over here. And when I got it, I just finished writing an article called The Stage is Set, to the effect that now that Wallace has been shot, get ready for the big surprises. And his wording was almost identical. I just completed writing one article, and this is the way Justine wrote it. He says, that, in quotes, "The shooting of George Wallace was nothing but the eye-catching prelude to a more important devilry planned by the CIA to save the Nixon maladministration from disaster. It says it was a diversionary maneuver of wide scope for the American public in advance, so they won't recognize the second coup d'etat in the making." He refers to the first coup d'etat where the government was overthrown in Dallas, and then the second coup d'etat is going to be the one where they take their total fascist control. I just finished writing the article, and I referred to the baby coup of 1963 and the big daddy coup of 1972. The big daddy coup is going to where this constitution gets in, when the cabinet gets in. But the baby coup was the little one in Dallas where they switched their hands, but all the wheels weren't tightened like we have now, you see. The Nixon regime, he said, is supported by oil, corporate giants who are committed to self-preservation. He said Nixon used to be the international outlaw par excellence, and now he's the nation's number one outlaw for arranging the Wallace shooting, the Wallace killing. He says, like, the CIA and Nixon are closer than anybody could imagine. And again, the CIA set up the assassination attempt on Wallace. Now, if you don't believe that these things are possible, there was an article this week in the LA Times about the new director of the FBI. And it tells how the FBI went into the case of the shooting of Wallace. I'll do this one next week on the show, but it says Arthur Bremer went into a hospital to have some stitches taken care of when he was hurt at the shopping center. He went in with a policeman into the hospital, and he came out a suspect of the FBI that they took him over. And he went in the hospital as a county prisoner, and he came out as part of the FBI. And on one of the shows, I mentioned how he needed medical care, and Nixon and the Justice Department sent word to Maryland he can have medical care if an FBI man is there, present in the room. So this article by the author's name is TRB. He uses those initials. It says the only suspect in the scene was hurt in the crowd, and he went to the hospital as a county prisoner, and the FBI took care of him. Now, it said the FBI went to Bremer's car and found nothing in the car but a lot of clutter and belongings, see? And they said, there's nothing here. It's okay. Then the policeman in Maryland went in the car and found a gun hidden in the door. And it said the FBI, this Pat McGrady III, who's going to be the head of the FBI, has closed the case and didn't even want to. The gun was inside the door. The police in Maryland found it later. And Gray said, and his officer said, there's nothing in the car. That's the way they did at Dealey Plaza. There's photographs of them picking shells up off the grass at Dealey Plaza and putting them in their pocket and saying that they're, you know, one of the things that Sprague showed was one of the agents reached, going on the ground, picking up something and putting it in his pocket. Really cool, like, you know. So the FBI didn't find this big gun that was in at the door of the car. So Justine claims that the public agencies, I use that as an example and get off from his newsletter, because this is, in fact, what is happening. So he says the Wallace made himself expendable to people like Nixon, and he was, in fact, he says, an expendable decoy. He was usurping what was going to happen in the country. And he said, you know, he talks about Humpty Dumpty, Laird, and all the other people who put up a pretense of an electoral system. But Wallace was an expendable decoy because he was a nuisance lately, and they could use him. The phony story circulated by Newsweek and newsfakers, Justine says, according to Brammer, that he wanted to assassinate the great Richard Nixon himself before he settled for Wallen was an extra dividend they threw in, he said. Remember we talked about that? He says that was an extra dividend. Nixon is an old hand at rigging up phony assassination attempts about himself. You know, he had those cars thrown at Venezuela and so forth. Well, he goes on to the whole... It's a long article. There's so much to cover in the news, you know, these days. It's a whole long article on Brammer at the Waldorf Astoria and the connection, you know, with the CIA. And it says the next installment in the CIA's chain of political murders is in the making. The next lonely misfit is standing by for instructions, and you have to be dumb and blind not to see the handwriting on the wall. And who's going to be the next victim? Well, it could be anybody. It could be that poor, pompous slob Spiro Agnew waiting in the wings to take his place. Or the revenge could be on McGovern or Kennedy, or simply cancel the elections. He says, this isn't the exact scenario, but the Nixon gang is working, and it's bound to be doing something. You want to read this? Yeah.
This is interesting here from his newsletter, quoting the London Daily Mail of May 16th, 1972. Police said the suspected gunman did not act alone. They started an intensive hunt in Maryland for a blue Cadillac with Georgia license plates. And Justine says, now here you have a good hot lead pointing to a getaway car. The number of blue Cadillacs registered in Georgia can't be astronomical. Far less concrete evidence would enable a competent law enforcement agency to track down Bremer's accomplice. So what happens? The FBI takes over, easing the local police out, and presto, there's no evidence of conspiracy. On the other hand, the Sunday Times of May 21st, that's the Sunday Times in London of May 21st, after a lot of research by two of its top reporters, came up with a series of startling facts which show beyond a shadow of a doubt that Bremer, though he had no job and had been loafing for at least 4 months, was well equipped with cash. According to Time, Bremer in 1971 had earned $1,611, which is hardly the stuff, Justine says, sizable nest eggs are made of. Yet after having quit work, Bremer miraculously was able to A, buy a 1968 model blue Rambler, B, rent a $135 apartment in Milwaukee, C, crisscross the United States for 4 months, covering many thousands of miles, and D, stay for 2 nights at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, where a single room costs at least $35 a night. It was a good thing, Justine says, that the American press lightly skipped this extraordinarily revealing item, for otherwise people might have started to wonder where all that money came from.
Well, another point which I made to send to Joe Justine in Europe, I made a letter out this week, was not only did they have a lead on that blue Cadillac in Maryland, I don't know if we mentioned this last week, they had a six foot two gentleman who weighed 220 pounds who was driving the blue Cadillac. But up in Milwaukee, the man at the ferry boat crossing said that Bremer was with a good husky man who was 6 foot two, 225 pounds. Now, in the interim, since we were on the show last week, where you had a man, the exact description given at two different places, and one had been let go as a suspect, the case was closed by the FBI. They didn't even bring those two people in, and we didn't hear what floor he stayed on or who he saw in New York. The suspect up in Milwaukee had a New York accent. The case is closed with no evidence. I don't know if I have time to read it quickly.
No, not really.
But time's out. We'll do it next week.
Time's up.
Yeah.
One thing we could mention, though, is another letter that you received at station here concerning some envelopes that state on the out there black mailing envelopes, and they state in mourning for one lost in Vietnam or something like that, and one of our listeners asked if we could maybe mention that.
Maybe they could make envelopes for us that are more inclusive. You know, maybe I should write to her and have her design an envelope for... You see, she's talking about Vietnam, and she was in the war in Vietnam. Our government allowed 100,000 people to be killed in Burundi. I haven't heard 50,000 since April. The Watusi tribe, which holds, 12% of the government, allowed these natives to be slaughtered because they felt the oppression there. You see, the problem is genocide in Brazil, defoliating 10% of the Earth's oxygen and putting concrete down in Brazil. It isn't just Vietnam. I object to people saying, I don't want this jelly or this electric bombing there, when the total thing is that the people in power have murdered our electoral system and murdered the candidates, and until you get them out of power, you can't effect the bombing. It's such a small part of the actual killing of your candidates.
Part of the picture.
Yeah.
Anyway, if anybody's interested in those envelopes, they're $25 for a dollar, and you can get them at Bookshop Santa Cruz or at the bookstore up on the UC Santa Cruz campus. So there, we mentioned it and hope you'll consider that.